Donald Trump is back in the White House and with a bang. But it hasn't just been a busy week in the United States. Germany has experienced another tragic stabbing attack. China may be gearing up to invade Taiwan. And Israel is coming to terms with what looks like now a disastrous hostage deal. We have all this and more on today's Trumpet World. Donald Trump has done his homework. He was inaugurated as president on Monday. And I'm going to begin with perhaps the toughest ever assignment on this program. Andrew, can you summarize briefly everything that he's done this week?
Well, that may just be the toughest ever assignment on this program, because Trump has definitely been busy. He took the oath of office noon on Monday, only been president a couple days now, and has actually, on his first afternoon, after giving his inaugural speech, has taken more than 200 executive actions. 26 of those 200 were official executive orders, which actually is the record for executive orders for any president since we've been keeping record. Now, originally, some people might be a little concerned seeing that much, like just like executive decrees coming so fast. It almost seems regal. Although 78 of these 200 executive actions, about 40% of them, were explicitly saying, remember that a previous executive order that either Obama or Biden passed, we're canceling that. So about 40% of them were just canceling previous executive orders. The other ones, they ranged from the symbolic to the substantial. On the symbolic side, they definitely made sure that the flags were at full mast for this patriotic inauguration. There was some question about them being at half mast because President Carter died so recently. They officially renamed Mount Denali in Alaska to Mount McKinley, officially renamed the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of America. I don't know if the rest of the world's on board with that one yet. I've heard Britain's still calling it the Gulf of Mexico. But in America, it's officially the Gulf of America now. He did an executive order declaring drug cartels terrorist organizations, an executive order sealing the border, and an executive order ordering a mass deportation. Last I looked, and this was more than a day ago, they've already arrested 308 illegal immigrants for deportation, so wasting no time there. There was a pretty, what I was pretty excited about, series of seven executive orders designed to downsize the U.S. government. This is part of the DOGE agenda to make the government smaller, where an executive order saying that people working from their home due to COVID restrictions have to come back to work now, an executive order saying that you can't hire new government employees, and a number, an executive order saying that all government departments have to present Trump with a staff reduction plan, just trying to shrink this 2.3 million man bureaucracy that's governing the United States. Another one saying that the U.S. government officially only recognizes two genders, male and female, and so they're going to be laying off most of the diversity, equity, and inclusion people the government's currently paying. And then some other ones about tariffs. I think Canada, Mexico, and China are going to be the first three countries up for tariffs. Those don't actually kick in until February 1st, but then there'll be discussions more about it. But that seems to be the several main things that all these executive actions are trying to do is reverse the Obama agenda, seal the U.S. southern border, reduce the size of the U.S. bureaucracy, and start trying to attack our trade deficit by putting tariffs on our three biggest trade partners, which are China, Mexico, and Canada.
Well, thanks for that. That did end up being a pretty succinct summary. I did toy with the idea of having some kind of ticking clock up there on the screen for you to count down as we try to fit in everything that happened. And I think it's also just been interesting. I've seen people comment where they've looked at these executive orders and said, like, yeah, these are really well thought through. And we have seen pushback. I think I saw a story just yesterday where a judge revoked this birthright citizenship, which I don't think anyone is surprised. Like, I think everything I've ever seen about this order, this executive order from Donald Trump that ends birthright citizenship for children of illegal immigrants, I think everyone's expecting this to end up in the Supreme Court. So not really too surprised that there's been some pushback. But by flooding so much, that probably has limited even the pushback. The opposition is almost just overwhelmed by the sheer volume of proposal, the business of activity. So clearly he's been preparing this for some time. But also, I think you want to talk a bit about, too, his inaugural speech. I mean, those are always significant milestones. That Monday itself, when he took power, right?
Yes. Yeah, that was a really inspiring speech. I should have looked into this. I actually don't know if he writes these himself. I'm sure he has some speechwriters helping him, where he announced a new golden age for the United States. He had some very soaring rhetoric, talking about America's manifest destiny, pledging to put American astronauts on Mars. We've already got people talking about Mars as the 53rd state after Canada and Greenland. But then he had one statement that our executive editor, Mr. Stephen Fleury, quoted in his trumpet brief this week that was not as positive, but definitely bold. Because now remember, Michelle Obama didn't come, but Barack Obama was there. Joe Biden was there. Jill Biden was there. I believe Kamala Harris was there. President Bush was there. So all these former presidents and people who've been attacking Donald Trump for so many years were sitting just a few feet away from him during the speech. And he said this statement, it says, "Our recent election is a mandate to completely and totally reverse the horrible betrayal and all these many betrayals that have taken place and to give the people back their faith, their wealth, their democracy, and indeed their freedom. From this moment on, America's decline is over. Our liberties and our nation's glorious destiny will no longer be denied, and we will immediately restore the integrity, competency, and loyalty of America's government." So not just saying that he disagreed with the Obama administration or the Biden administration, but actually talking about like treason and betrayal, which are words we've used at the trumpet for years, and Donald Trump's used as well. So, but I just think it was bold that like Joe Biden sitting like something like 6 feet from him as he's talking about how horribly he betrayed the nation and about how America's decline is over from here on out.
I mean, I thought it was remarkable, not just the ex-politicians that were sitting just a few feet away from him, but that all of the tech gurus that were sitting there and paying even like $1 million into supporting the inauguration fund, sitting on that stage, standing up, applauding him. I mean, it was such a powerful symbol of how different this is to the first inauguration. And different people have very different views of Donald Trump. He's a very polarizing figure. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in just a minute. But I think... there are some things that are unambiguously true, no matter what background you come from, that you'll agree on. And I think one is he did a lot this week. Now, some people may believe that's a lot of bad things, but certainly he came in and he did a lot. But the other is that he has come in with a way broader support this time. Like, this is, the difference is massive. Like, he doesn't have
I mean, I don't know. I don't know how sincere. I don't. Who knows what's going on in the background? But at least publicly, he doesn't have Mark Zuckerberg and Jeff Bezos and what was it? The Google guy, Sam Altman, OpenAI, like some of the richest, most influential people in the United States. They're not against him now. They're for him. They're standing behind him, giving him standing ovations. He has a lot more power, a lot more support this time than he did the first time. And this is right in line with everything that we have prophesied, or that Mr. Flurry has prophesied, ultimately the Bible prophesies. I think this is just incredible. Like, we can now see the full picture. We can now look back, and we knew from Bible prophecy, Mr. Flurry said back in 2020, well, Donald Trump has more to do here. The Bible has some specific prophecies about what he's going to get done in office. We're at 2020, we're at the end of his first term in office. He hasn't done all those things yet. So he said, well, Donald Trump's going to remain in office. That's what he thought. That's what we thought at the time. Obviously, that didn't happen. But Mr. Flurry remained throughout all those 4 years of the Biden's time in the White House saying, well, Donald Trump is going to come back. Those prophecies still aren't fulfilled. And then he brought in more truth from the Bible. He talked about prophecies that indicated that Barack Obama's power would be limited and would be restrained. And that, I think, is really what was on display with that stage. And all of these people that were once enthralled to the Democratic radical left, at least in public, are having to go and kind of pay lip service and show their loyalty to Donald Trump. That Barack Obama's power has been largely broken. Exactly the way that Mr. Flurry wrote about just even during the summer, talking about that you're going to see that power being broken, that power being reduced. So, and I don't think if Donald Trump had stayed in power in 2020, he wouldn't have stayed in power with that level of support that he returned to power now in 2025. That you kind of had to have that interruption, that 4 years where he was out of the White House, for there to be this complete routing of Barack Obama's power and allies, and for there to be such a massive shift. So really, Donald Trump himself said, well, God save me to do a job here. You know, Donald Trump himself in that inauguration speech saw God's hand in his presidency. And really that hand in his presidency is so detailed. And we've got a whole lot of material on that we're working on. I think it went out to print yesterday, the latest Trumpet print edition. If you keep an eye on our website, thetrumpet.com, that should probably be coming up, I think, probably in the next week, where there's a lot about that, the inauguration and what is coming. But that's just one massive piece of fulfilled prophecy. And I think, Andrew, you had a bit more to talk about that.
Yeah, I definitely think that is a bit of a change in even Donald Trump's outlook as he's gone through this 8-year journey in politics so far. I remember about this time in his first term, he was making a lot of statements like, I alone can fix it. I'm rich, I'm powerful, I'm the only one who's got the sense and the common the knowledge to fix America's problems. And I don't know if his attitude's changed much, but he has pivoted at least a little bit to seeing that, like, well, God is, for one reason or another, God is using me to do this. The other good point is just the public mandate, because, like you said, his first term, he'd lost the popular vote, and the Electoral College victory was pretty narrow. So he was kind of, he didn't have an extremely strong public mandate like he does now, where he won the popular vote, landslide victory in the Electoral College. Another first that he did on his inauguration day is he's the first president, all these executive orders he's signing, he's like the first president to do this in front of like a huge crowd instead of the Oval Office. So you can see footage of him. He's just sitting there signing executive orders and then like throwing the pen into the crowd like he's a rock star or something like that, which is one of the most Trump things you could do. But it does also highlight the fact that for years, the Obama administration and the Biden administration have been ruling America basically like a technocratic dictatorship where there's 17 bureaucratic regulations passed for every law passed by Congress. And all these laws, they're being written by bureaucrats and deep state operatives and in back rooms, and there's no transparency. So here you've got President Trump reversing a lot of these Biden and Obama policies, but and not doing it in a back room or doing back deals, but like sitting there in public in front of a crowd showing like, all right, here's the executive order I'm going to sign, signs it. Chucks the pen to a fanboy in the audience. And I just think that whole thing was just really symbolic, is that Trump's leading a populist revolution against the American deep state, or he's leading a movement that has popular support, 77 million voters, won the popular vote, against this movement that has been telling us for years that like the American people aren't smart enough to make these decisions. We need some well-educated technocrats behind the scenes to interpret what Congress really meant when they made that law. And that is a big shift in American politics going forward.
So it's a big shift for the United States. A new president, especially one so dramatically different from his predecessor, is clearly a big shift for the rest of the world. And we've asked Joshua Michels to come on our live Week in Review show today, because I wanted to get some of the latest from Germany, their view of the Trump presidency. I mean, looking at the UK media, I've been struck by how different this is to the first time round. Like for those of us here in the UK, even for people on the right, Donald Trump's first election, first inauguration, people were pretty appalled. I don't think he was popular really at all. Yeah, there were a small number, but even most on the right didn't like him. And I think, you know, British politics is very, Boris Johnson, he said, I'm more likely to be reincarnated than an olive than become prime minister. Like, we never like people that say, I'm going to be president and I'm going to be a fantastic president and I'm going to be the best. Like, you don't, it's just, whatever our own biases and sensibilities, he wasn't particularly popular. This time round, it is very, very different. I've just pulled together some headlines from the British press. Why we Brits envy the US having Donald Trump. Where was it? Oh, Trump's billionaire oligarchs are rewiring America for a new superpower era. If Britain's leaders acted like Trump, they'd stop the boat, start deportations, kill quangos, that's kind of some of our bureaucrats, and sack woke civil servants. Then perhaps we'd all be rich like the Americans. That was a headline in the Daily Mail. So we, you know, very different view this time around. Not from the left. The left is still absolutely appalled. This was from like the Mail and the Telegraph, the right-wing papers. But the right are jealous. There's a writer looking on and seeing we've had leaders that have promised to do the same things that Donald Trump has done, and they've been in power for the last 10 years and they've done nothing. Donald Trump has come to power and in a week he's done more than 10, 15 years of conservative government has done. So there's that. I think there's also a sense of Donald Trump, save us. God, like that he is even saving us from some of the terrible, ridiculous things that the left-wing Labour government is doing. For example, they've been desperate not just to give away the Chagos Islands and the Diego Garcia military base, but to pay billions to Mauritius that have never owned these islands before. They're not like islands we took from them or anything like that. And the Labour government wants to pay to give them away. And it looks like Donald Trump might stop that because the US has a military base there on Diego Garcia as well and has rights to access to that base. And there's a whole number of ways where they're kind of saying, well, maybe even Donald Trump will save us from the worst excesses of Keir Starmer and the Labour. So very, very different reaction here in the UK to Donald Trump's return to office than when he came to power in 2016. What I'm curious about, and what we've got Joshua in here to talk about, is the reaction from Germany. Because we did a live show, I think it might have been our first live show ever, the morning after Donald Trump was elected. You were talking then about how you had family members saying, hey, you're in America, because you were at the time, can you go assassinate him? Like, a lot of hatred for Donald Trump. So what is the situation now after this week? Has it shifted?
There are a lot of people that are saying that Trump would be worse this time around because he has much more power. So that still seems to be the consensus. But I see some admiration on left and right too. For example, they say, hey, that guy gets things done. Germany debates about deporting migrants and he deports them like that. In just a few days, he makes a decrease and it's going forward. We are talking about solving the Middle East crisis and he makes a deal. Now, you can argue that the deal may not be good at all. And they may be praising him for the wrong reasons, but yeah, saying like, wow, he's getting things done. But the overall consensus is still that he is a danger to democracy. Even the German ambassador to the United States, a memo from him was leaked where he said that he will be largely sapping the US of its democratic principles. And the German foreign minister was asked, well, that's dangerous to say something like that from a diplomat that's supposed to help us have good relations with the United States. And she basically said, well, he just speaks about reality at hand. So it's not very professional dealing with that. I think that they're trying to shift more, like, we need to have good relations with America. But then you also had Ursula von der Leyen, the German European Union Commission president, said, well, we also need to shift toward China. So I would say there are three different kinds of reactions. There's the usual hatred, there's the admiration. And I think the most prophetically significant one is, hey, there might be an opportunity for us. And we can maybe talk a little bit about that later. But first of all, I want to just say, why is Germany so concerned about it? Now, the German people actually don't have to worry too much. Right now, President Trump hasn't imposed tariffs on Europe. He doesn't even mention Europe much in his inauguration speech or anything like that. He's concerned about domestic issues. He's concerned about solving some wars right now. So it's not really at hand that he wants to start a trade war with Germany. But some of the appointments that he made, for example, concerning trade, are concerning Germany, and also exiting the climate change agreement, that's a big deal for Germany. Why? Because Germany doesn't export oil, they don't export gas, they export green technology, they are big into solar energy, and they are producing a lot of those kinds of technology, and they are exporting it. I think they are competing with China and the largest exporter. So if you scale back the climate change hoax and people don't buy into that anymore, then Germany is actually losing some of its trade in that way. And then he also exits the World Health Organization and he appoints people that have been anti-lockdown, anti-coronavirus lockdown, and Germany has some skeletons they want to hide about the true scientific evidence about the lockdowns and the true scientific evidence about a vaccine that they have been promoting. So you can see that the German elite, they have some legitimate things that they are concerned about. And a little bit less concerning is that Trump might be invading Greenland, and they say, like, this is part of Europe because it's part of Denmark, who's part of the European Union. So, and then the Panama Canal is another thing. We're like, oh, is he going to be like another Putin right now? Now you see more people that say, like, well, I don't think he's actually going to invade those countries and the Panama Canal. But you see that, like, we don't know how to handle with this kind of man that has some power. So the consensus on left and right is we need to be a power ourselves.
Yeah, we've seen, I don't know whether it's concrete steps, but certainly big talk about that just even this week. I mean, you mentioned Ursula von der Leyen talking about how we need to shift towards China. The German leader and the French leader, Olaf Scholz, Emmanuel Macron, I think they got together this week to talk about that. Emmanuel Macron called for a European strategic awakening. So certainly there's this, like, we all need to come together. We all need to have a strong leader. We need our own Donald Trump. And I think that can come from a place of, say, envy for those that do look at Donald Trump and say, hey, I wish we had a leader that could get stuff done like he's getting done. those people are going to want a strong leader, because part of the reason why Europe gets nothing done is you have everything divided up between different levels of authority. There's kind of the European level, and there's the states level, and it feels like European law gets in the way of heads of states getting anything done, and then countries get in the way of Europe getting anything done. So big change, strong leader for those that kind of maybe like him and envy him, but then also for those that really don't like him, well, if they're going to stand up and combat him effectively, again, well, we need our own Donald Trump, our own strong European leader.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting that they're bringing the two parts together. I just saw an interview from the former German defense minister, Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg. He's kind of right and left. He kind of brings them together. But he said, well, we might need a Giorgio Meloni in Italy, and we might need a Viktor Orban in Hungary, that are bringing the power of their countries into the European Union, that we together can then speak to Donald Trump. Because Hungary, for example, they are close to Russia, and he was, Viktor Orban said, like, well, we have to wait and see what Donald Trump may do. And he hoped that he would be looser on Putin, and now that he wants to impose sanctions on Russia, which would hurt the Hungarian industry too, and then tariffs on the European Union. So Hungary is like, well, I can't really rely on the United States right now. So that will drive them closer into the European Union. But as you said, who is going to speak to Donald Trump? Is it going to be Giorgia Meloni? Is it going to be Viktor Orban? Is it going to be von der Leyen? I have seen quite a few articles that said, well, von der Leyen really has to step it up now to be able to negotiate it on eye level on Donald Trump's level. But really, no one really believes that they could. But we do have a clip from Guttenberg that we often point to, and he's just very strong about Donald Trump in that clip that I wanted to show.
Jetzt kann man 3 Jahre warten, meine Damen und Herren, und sagen, es wird eine Zeit nach Trump geben. Es ist aber auch nicht ausgeschlossen, dass der möglicherweise wiedergewählt wird. Trotz Charlottesville, trotz einer völlig gespaltenen Nation, vielleicht sogar gerade deswegen, weil es mittlerweile auch dort Menschen gibt, die ihm immer noch glühend und enthusiastisch hinterherlaufen.
So he's just saying that 3 years ago, so Donald Trump was 1 year in office, and he said 3 years later, he might become reelected. No, there was a Biden break for 4 years, but he was right. There were enough people that reelected Donald Trump, and actually it's millions more this time around that voted for him. So he has been watching Donald Trump for a long time. He has been living in the United States. So a lot of people are coming to him like, explain us this guy, explain us America under him. So there are a lot of people that are looking to him as an expert. So talking about a strong leader, talking about someone who knows Donald Trump, who knows how to deal with these kind of things. And another headline that I just saw that the European Union wants to implement is like a digital euro in response to the cryptocurrencies, because that's threatening the banking system in Europe, because people go to cryptocurrencies, they're not having their money in the bank necessarily. So they're saying we need that, and that's something Guttenberg has been watching. He has been watching geopolitical events. So a lot of people are watching him right now because he has been talking about those topics.
So just to place all of this in its broader context, I have a clip as well. This was from when Germany's government collapsed right after Donald Trump was elected, and Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry gave a really powerful Key of David talking about that. This is just a clip from that Key of David show showing how significant this is and giving you a picture of what we're watching for overall with Europe.
The collapse of Germany's government will lead to a dramatic change for Germany and Europe and the whole world. There's going to be a strong leader that comes on the scene to lead this European Union, which will become the Holy Roman Empire with 10 kings, and he will rule over all of them. That is the Bible prophecy that we need to understand. And I think that could happen in just weeks, certainly in a few months.
So that's what we're watching for overall. And Mr. Flurry he's building that prophecy off of what is written in Revelation 17 and many other scriptures, and what Herbert W. Armstrong before him was saying for many, many years, that you would have a resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. And Revelation 17 talks about the beast that was and is not and yet is. You know, beast being an empire in biblical symbolism, and it was and is not and yet is. It's on the scene, it disappears from the scene, it comes back again. And that script, that passage talks about this empire rising and falling, being there and disappearing seven times. It's a resurrection of what has come before. And so you saw Germany's government collapse immediately after Donald Trump came to power. And I think you see the rise of Donald Trump in that way, as a strong man, or kind of a strong man, standing up for America's interest in the world, that and Europe's reaction to that, and in some ways Europe's hatred for that, that pushing the rise of the strong man. But also what's rising in Europe is connected to the previous resurrection, and what came before was the Nazis and the fascists in Europe in World War II. And what we have been seeing over recent years is political parties with ties to those Nazi and fascist parties come to power in European countries. So Giorgia Meloni, whose party is the political descendant of Benito Mussolini's party, who is basically, you know, Mussolini's supporters started a particular party, and then some offshoots started another party, and some offshoots from that started another party. And that's kind of how you get Giorgia Meloni's party. Austria, party of founded by a couple of ex-SS members coming to the... looks like they're going to provide the next Austrian chancellor. In Germany, you've got the Alternative for Deutschland that has a radically revisionist view of World War II history, believes the Nazis were not the singular bad guys. Some of them maybe even look at the Nazis as the good guys. I think generally what the view that they push is, well, Churchill was evil, Franklin Roosevelt was evil, Hitler was evil, we unfairly got saddled with the blame. But really, it's a kind of a victim complex, and glorifies Nazi history. And one of their leaders said, we need to be proud of what our soldiers accomplished in World War I and World War II. So you've got these powers rising and these parties rising. Who from Europe was invited to Donald Trump's inauguration? Well, it was Giorgia Meloni, and she was one of the other people that was on stage behind Donald Trump. And it was the AfD, and it was the AfD leader, is it Timo Schiaparella?
Yes.
There we go, better make sure I say that right. The Alternative for Deutschland that was right there. So I think this is a separate way that you're seeing this Holy Roman Empire rise, tied in with Donald Trump's return to the White House, where he and people around him, like Elon Musk, I don't think deliberately, I don't think maliciously, but I do think negligently, are promoting the rise of basically these people that represent the resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. You're seeing him encourage the rise of the Holy Roman Empire in that way.
Yeah, and they have things in common, like they are against migration and things like that. And from those things that they have in common, they believe that there is a consensus. But even you have pointed out in some of your articles that once you have an independent Europe, you will see the differences very, very quickly. Once, and many are asking that right now, to double their military spending in Europe for Trump because of the wars. But once you have that, you will see the differences between those parties anymore. A fascist party only will disguise its own ambitions till it has the power and the might to use what it is doing. And even on migration, yes, you can have concerns about migration, but you also can be genuine racist. Those people still exist. We sometimes may forget about them, but they are still out there where they say, and it often starts like this, you say, all the problems that we have right now are on migration. Now, a lot of problems might be because of migration, but not all. For example, an AfD ad is like, it's an all German white town, and then the migrant comes in and the problems are starting. So if you just go back before the migrants are coming, everything was better. But was it better during the time of Adolf Hitler, where he was making sure that the German race was more pure, that they didn't intermarry even with other white people, just as Jews? So it was a more pure white German race, but the problems were different, but they were existing there. So you got to be careful who you're promoting, because you might agree with someone, yeah, we shouldn't let migrants in, but why is that one person saying we shouldn't let migrants in, and why are you concerned? It might be very different ideology.
Very different backgrounds to why they want that. And even, I mean, you mentioned it's going to be a different Germany. Alice Weidel, the co-leader of the Alternative for Deutschland, along with Timo Chaparella, she wrote in the American Conservative. She says, right now, we Germans, Germany is America's slave. I've got the article here. What did exactly she said? She said we're slave, but she also, being a slave also has its advantages. And she says slaves don't fight. And basically, the whole gist of that article is we're a kind of a vassal nation to America right now. And yeah, you tell us to take responsibility and to build up our army. We'll do that. But if we do that, we're going to have very different views from you about what happens in this world, what we do in the world, and we're not going to listen to you anymore. And yeah, that's coming straight from... That's not us saying that. That's the leader of the Alternative for Deutschland saying that. I mean, maybe before we wrap up, you mentioned migrants. And I mean, this is where it is not a complicated issue, but you're right. Like, there is a genuine problem with migration in Germany. And you do have the kind of some neo-Nazis that are concerned about that. But just because somebody's concerned about migration, that absolutely does not mean that they're neo-Nazi. You know, if somebody's concerned about too much migration into America, that absolutely does not make them a Nazi. If somebody's concerned about migration to Germany, that does not make them a Nazi, that alone. And we saw some of the tragic consequences of that uncontrolled migration in Germany this week as well, where you had an Afghan national who was supposed to have been deported take a knife to a park with, as I understand it, the stated aim of stabbing little children.
Yeah, it was in a kindergarten. He was going for the little ones. He killed one of the children and he wounded another one, and then he killed also a man that intervened, and he killed that man too, and then injured another one. And that's by far the only tragedy that Germany has suffered from terrorist attacks like that. And they say he was mental ill and they put him in a mental ill facility. But the problem is really in ideology behind some of those things that as people get in their education growing up, what they're getting taught as they themselves as children are getting taught that ideology, and then they commit those crimes. And the problem really is in Germany, the law has not been enforced. That's another thing, like you can have migration, but you need to enforce strict laws on people following the laws of the land. And if they don't, they have to face the consequences. And that's really what people would need to enforce. But the problem is right now that they are always pushing for deportation, 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 and just nothing has happened. But in this case, actually, it's the campaign time, 3 weeks or so is election time, so things are a little different. And the opposition party, the CDU, led by Friedrich Merz, who might be the next chancellor, he's saying, like, we need to deal now because he wants to be elected chancellor. And he says, no, let's push for a package. And I don't even care if the AfD votes for that package. We ourselves voted, we rejected the AfD, writing up their own deal. We made our own that looks exactly like theirs, essentially. But we don't care if they vote for us. So there might be like a package on migration now where the opposition parties, led by Friedrich Merz, are making a deal aside from the ruling coalition, which is very interesting because they're saying we don't have enough time to wait for the election. I'm stepping in, leading the opposition. We can get a majority together ourselves and start acting things like that. So you already see that there's a shift in leadership to someone wants to get something done, and he might be able to get something done.
So Donald Trump is showing how much an effective leader can do. A lot of Europe is jealous of this. Their appetite for a strong leader, both to, if they oppose Trump, to stand up to him or to be like him. You know, they want their strong leader. Germany, as you say, has elections coming up at the end of February. And at the same time, Europe is really divided, and especially Germany is very divided. The polls indicate complex coalition negotiations. Two election cycles ago in Germany, it took them about 6 months before they finally got a coalition together. We could well be heading there. And that was a point that Mr. Flurry emphasized in that Key of David and then in the article that was in our January Trumpet print edition, that Europe is going to get its strong leader. But the Bible tells us that this strong leader is going to come in by flatteries, that he's not going to come in. The Bible uses by flatteries. It says they're not going to give him the honor of the kingdom. This is in Daniel chapter 8. And so we're watching for this leader to come in through some unorthodox means, not to come in by, you know, he's not going to win a landslide election and take power with all the people behind him. So we're watching now for this to happen in Europe. And you can really see how we're getting set up for that to happen. And Europe needs a strong leader to take care of these problems, you know, these stabbings, things like that. So this is the big thing to watch for now, or one massive thing to watch for, the rise of a strong leader in Europe.
Yeah, that's why Mr. Flurry has often pointed to Carl Theodor zu Guttenberg as the man. And Mr. Armstrong, even before him, he has pointed to some very specific points as an economic crisis that might be triggering the rise of this man and the unification of Europe. And he has pointed to various other factors that we are seeing building. Another factor is the fear of Russia, which we are seeing right now, and the increased military spending that will lead to more substantiated leadership that will be needed for that. So we see all those things coming together, which demands a leader. And you could very well see what they say with Donald Trump, with Putin, who continues to fight in Ukraine, with the Middle East continuing to be about to explode, they need a leader now. So we see the stage being set for it, for sure.
And even when we played the Key of David, you saw that picture from Mr. Flurry, a strong German leader is imminent. We've got that up on the screen right now, where you can get that, you can download that, you can look at all of the scriptures that I've mentioned today, and you can prove that for yourself. You know, we've mentioned Daniel 8, we've mentioned Revelation 17. Don't take our word for it that refers to a strong German leader. You can prove it. You can get that book out. There's other material by Mr. Armstrong, things like Who and What is the Prophetic Beast, that is so simple, so crystal clear, that you can just take that, read that book alongside your Bible. And you can get that at our website, thetrumpet.com. You can order your own free print copy. I'd really encourage you to do that, so you can open that, have it out in front of you alongside the Bible without any electronic distractions. You can read it online as well. That's great too. And you can go and you can study that. So we, Andrew, violently dragged the conversation, I guess. We've got more and more into Europe from that segue from Donald Trump. But let's bring it back to you if you had any more last comments you wanted to make on Donald Trump's big week, and then any other bits of news you wanted to bring to us.
Well, yeah, I can wrap it up with a Donald Trump Europe comment, because obviously prophetically we're looking at the standpoint from 2 Kings 14 verses 26 through 28 and Amos 7 verses 5 through 7, which are talking about God passing by end time Israel one last time before the punishment comes. And that punishment, from the scriptures you referenced, is Holy Roman Empire invasion. But before that invasion comes, there's like one last resurgence in an American power that gives people a last chance to repent. And then looking at these executive orders and that content about God passing by Israel one last time is really interesting, because, and I think in some ways, despite Donald Trump's blind spots to some of these nationalist parties in Europe and Italy and Austria and in other countries, I do think more than most presidents, he does actually realize that there is a potential threat from the European Union. He wants to put a 20% tariff on the European Union. He says tariff's his favorite word in the dictionary. But despite as much as he loves tariffs, he's even looking at giving zero tariffs or tariff-free trade to Britain, specifically because he's a fan of Brexit, and he likes the fact that Brexit weakens the European Union. So it's like making an exception for Britain kind of chips away at this European power block. I even had a friend mention to me this week that it's interesting that like his moves, that people, some that have made fun of, like calling it the Gulf of America and wanting to get back Panama and wanting to buy Greenland. These are like the exact moves you'd want to make if you were expecting a future conflict with the European Union. The fact that, like, you control the Gulf of America, you control the Panama Canal, you can control Greenland, that makes it much more defensible. It almost seems like he's looking down the road and asking himself, if there was a third world war, what real estate do we have to control going into it? Panama and Greenland being high on that list to actually be able to defend the North American continent. So he's making some of the right moves in terms of, like, making sure that we control the sea gates, we dominate the North American continent, we make sure that Britain's more integrated with our economy than they are with Europe's economy, and things that could make a difference in a future conflict, if God allows them to happen. And that is the big if. Like, this is the last chance to repent, kind of showing America that, like, okay, well, these are the blessings you could have, the sea gates you could have if you follow my laws. But if you don't, you're already raising up this European superpower that's going to cause you a lot of problems.
I think that's a valuable perspective to bring to that as well. Well, thank you so much for that, Andrew. I think Jeremiah is also standing by to give us some significant, maybe directly or perhaps indirectly responding to Donald Trump and some preparations from China to be more involved with, or to, well, not be more involved with, to take over Taiwan.
That's right. And actually, there is some Trump tie-ins to this. But yeah, the big story is that we now have five glaring signs that China is preparing to conquer Taiwan. That is according to a new analysis published on Wednesday by The Telegraph. So we know that Chinese leader Xi Jinping, he sees the conquest of Taiwan as his political destiny. He knows that taking it would enshrine him in the pantheon of Chinese leaders as kind of a demigod in the minds of many Chinese, who was able to accomplish something that even Mao Zedong couldn't do. So it's kind of a prime directive of Xi Jinping. And The Telegraph says that the signs are all there showing that he could be ready to make his move very soon and make this a reality. They point first to the gray zone warfare that has become so ubiquitous around the Taiwan Strait, the nearly constant incursions by Chinese warplanes. 3,000 incursions last year alone, which is just a remarkable number. And these are not attacks, but just incursions, as I said, just gray zone intrusions into their airspace or air defense identification zone. And it's all intended to just kind of tire the enemy out before you even get to open combat. Just tire them out, because it's very expensive and very psychologically taxing for the comparatively small Taiwanese Air Force to always have to, you know, scramble jets to intercept this endless incursion of Chinese jets. And at the same time, it does give Chinese pilots a lot of practice for when the big day comes. And, you know, China's also bringing new weapons online all the time, like those barges that we spoke about last week. There's also a new class of frigates that they just announced this week, just to make sure that not only are they well equipped to have the overwhelming force they'll need for the time when this big move comes, but also to kind of rattle Taiwan and to make sure that Taiwan knows about this dramatic buildup that's happening just across the Taiwan Strait there. So gray zone warfare is number one. Number two is coercive tactics. These are probably best illustrated by the large-scale military drills that China held in waters near Taiwan last month without any real fanfare. So that was really the big difference between these most recent drills and the numerous sets of exercises that have taken place there in the past. And it's just that there was no real fanfare from China, no big warnings or announcements ahead of time. So this is about normalizing an increased Chinese military presence there, and just kind of showing Taiwan and the world that China could attack whenever it wants to. And that's all designed to kind of pressure the Taiwanese to want to surrender before they have to risk so much bloodshed and devastation. The third factor they discuss is Taiwan's delay in integrating its weapon systems with those of the United States. There have been some notable delays there, and this leaves the window wide open for China. And it actually means that Xi Jinping knows that he needs to strike soon rather than waiting for those integrations to happen, since they will make his war much more costly. And then number four is propaganda. Taiwanese authorities say that last year, the number of pieces of biased or false information that China fed to Taiwanese citizens went up 60%, up to 2.16 million items, mostly on sites like Facebook and X and TikTok, where there are just armies of Chinese trolls disseminating this propaganda nonstop. Propaganda that says resisting China is futile and America will not come to Taiwan's aid, that kind of thing, over and over, just getting those messages into the minds, making them take up lodgment in the craniums of the Taiwanese. And then the last item the Telegraph pointed to is diplomacy toward Trump. So this one may prove invalid. We don't know for sure. They may have missed the mark here, but they say that Xi Jinping knows from Trump's first term that Trump has serious doubts about America's alliances in Asia. And that he has real misgivings about America's role as kind of the defender of many nations. And I think there have been a lot of statements from Trump and even some actions showing that that could be the case to a degree. But analysts believe that Xi Jinping could try to work out some kind of a deal with Trump that could essentially buy him permission to make his move on Taiwan. So we'll have to wait and see there. But when you put all of this together, the way the Telegraph did, it does paint a compelling picture, and it shows that the Taiwan Strait could soon be the world's next big flashpoint.
I think it's an interesting story. In some ways, it ties into, I think, some of what we're going to talk about next with Mihailo, who has magically appeared now in the seat next to me with some movie magic here. Just a spoiler for what's coming up in just a few minutes. But you've got,
like, this looks like a big foreign policy test for President Trump. And Mr. Flurry spoke about Taiwan. He had a 2020 Key of David, China's biggest scandal ever against America. And well, he talks about the Panama Canal, but I think he set up Taiwan as almost a test of America's vision and strategic sense. So you can play that, George.
Just think about this. This is the Panama is 900 miles from Miami. And here you have a power moving in there that may very well put their attack jets in there, their nuclear bombs and bombers, and their nuclear submarines, and they're 900 miles from Miami. Do you think that's not going to be something that plagues us in the future? Where is our vision? Where is our world vision? We're so wrapped up in ourselves, we don't often even see what is happening. And we've really forsaken little Taiwan, who used to be our foreign ally, but we didn't have the courage to stand with them. And so they're now under the control of China as well.
So I think this point about world vision is fascinating. Like, Donald Trump does have a lot better world vision than I think any U.S. president we've seen in my lifetime. The way that he has gone after the Panama Canal. And we'll see, I guess, how far that world vision extends. It's been China's been able to get a lot of influence in Taiwan, a lot of control about that whole area, because America has had the power to stop it, but has not had the will, the pride in its power, to step in and intervene. And what is that going to look like under a Donald Trump presidency? And really, pride and power gets back to, well, is a nation looking to God? How is their morale doing? A lot of that just gets back to fundamental character. And I think that there's some things this week that have been a very good start. I mean, it might sound strange to connect this to Taiwan, but like getting rid of DEI initiatives and having the government say, no, there's just a man and a woman, and we're not going to call women men and men women. we're just going to get back to the basics of morality. Now, these are very, very basics. But if you build on that by promoting family and promoting having a strong family and getting rid of things that tear that down, you can build a generation of leaders and a generation of people that have world vision. And you can cultivate that within a nation. So there's an opportunity there, if the nation repents and turns back to God, to have some strategic vision. And if not, well, then I guess we might see some limits to that vision pretty quickly.
You know, I really appreciate that clip that you played from Mr. Fleury. That was from 2020, I believe you said, but he's actually been talking about the China-Taiwan dynamic since 1998, so more than 25 years now. And he's always placed the United States at the dead center of this dynamic, since the U.S. has long been the only thing standing in the way of China just using, you know, overwhelming force to seize Taiwan. But back in 1998, that's when Mr. Fleury wrote about U.S. President Bill Clinton making statements that kind of threw Taiwan under the bus, just publicly opposed Taiwanese independence. And he called the Taiwanese, Mr. Fleury called them, quote, our freedom-loving friends. And he made very clear in that article that America should support them. It is the right thing to do. But he said that Clinton's statements made clear that it was just a matter of time before China would take Taiwan. And he said that it was certain to go down that way because of what he called a, quote, pitifully weak-willed America. And he explained that his whole view of that dynamic is founded on Bible prophecy, and in particular, what you mentioned there a moment ago, Mr. Palmer, Leviticus 26, and the verse there, verse 19, showing that modern America would lose the will to really lose its power. And we have a free booklet called Russia and China in Prophecy, and there's a section in there all about China and Taiwan, and it's all built around Mr. Fleury's comments about this flashpoint. So I would encourage anyone who doesn't have a copy of Russia and China in Prophecy to pick up one of those and just learn the big picture context of this situation.
And we'll put a link to that in our show notes. And as I mentioned before, you can find that on our website, thetrumpet.com, and we're very happy to send that out to you. Well, of course, there have been other important developments in Asia. What else did you want to keep us up to date with, Jeremiah?
Yeah, first of all, a quick Russia story here about Vladimir Putin getting nervous about Russia's economy as President Trump applies more and more pressure on Russia about ending Russia's war on Ukraine. So we know that Trump had actually campaigned partly on promises to end this war within 24 hours. At one point, he said within 24 hours of being elected. But then another couple of times he said within 24 hours of being sworn in. But in either case, the window has closed and the war, of course, is still raging. And the picture that's beginning to emerge now is that Trump really was serious about, you know, brokering a very quick peace deal. And he pushed for one. And Ukraine was amenable to it, even though the deal would have been a bad one for Ukraine in the long term. But despite all of that, Putin is not playing ball. And really, it would be politically difficult for Putin to sell this to his people. It would be politically difficult for him to say, we've won, you know, partly because right now Russia controls about a third less of Ukraine than they did back in March of 2022. So it would be tough for him to sell this as a victory. Maybe he would be able to, but it would be difficult. So you can see why he would be reluctant to stop the war right now. But the trouble is, the Russian economy is starting to really feel the labor shortages, the sky-high interest rates, and the soaring inflation. All of those pains have become acute in the last few months. And now Trump is threatening more sanctions and tariffs as well on Russia. Trump said that if Putin doesn't negotiate, Russia's economy is headed for, quote, big trouble. That was earlier this week that Trump said that. And I think his assessment there is accurate. Trump is also pressuring NATO nations to ramp up their spending on defense to 5% of GDP. So that's very bad news for Russia. Russia doesn't like to see a strong, well-armed NATO. And then Trump is also pressuring China now to apply more pressure on Putin to negotiate. And then yesterday, Trump called Saudi Arabia's leaders to ask them to slash oil prices, which would dramatically shrink one of Putin's main sources of funding for the war. There was also a Bloomberg report yesterday showing that the cost of shipping Russian oil to China now has already gone up fivefold over the last couple of years, just because of largely because of some new sanctions that the U.S. levied. Chinese ports are very cautious about these new sanctions, as are Indian ports. So the fees are becoming just exorbitant. And this all seems to be adding up to put a significant amount of strain on the Russian economy. It won't be enough to stop Russia's war machine, but the cumulative pressure of all this could make Putin soon reconsider his refusal to at least pretend to make some kind of short-term deal. And then the last story that I wanted to mention is about Japan and China suddenly taking a whole flurry of diplomatic initiatives toward each other. So Japan and China, they've become deeply hostile toward each other in recent years, and they're both militarizing right now, largely out of fear of each other. But starting last month, we started to see a series of meetings. There was a big one between their foreign ministers in Beijing last month, and they surprised the world by saying that they would have another meeting early this year. And then probably the biggest bombshell of all was a report that Japanese Prime Minister Ishiba Shigeru himself might be traveling to China soon. So at this point, it's just some, you know, just some meetings, just some diplomatic initiatives, and not much of real substance. But there is at least an appearance that Japan-China ties could be on the mend. And that is an outcome that the trumpet has been expecting for many years now. So we'll be keeping a close watch on the developments there as they progress.
Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Well, as trailered, I am joined now by Mihailo Zekic to talk about what looks like Donald Trump's probably biggest misstep as he comes into office this week. I think we're only going to have time to cover this pretty briefly, but if you want to know more, Mr. Stephen Flurry went into this in great detail. Or more detail, at least, than we're going to have time to get into on yesterday's Trumpet Daily Show. So you can look that up on our website or on Rumble or YouTube, where he talked about this and had a whole lot to say about it. But we've gotten more details about this ceasefire deal that Mr. Trump's envoy kind of pushed Benjamin Netanyahu into signing. And the more we see of it, the worse it looks. And there's some pretty horrific, pretty horrible criminals that are released. You know, people that planned massive attacks, people that planned attacks on buses, people that, well, there's one person that murdered a Palestinian woman, was locked up, then raped a prison guard. You've got masterminds behind multiple attacks that are being released. So Israel, and then of course, Israel is being pressured to get out of Gaza, and it kind of looks like Hamas is being handed victory out of the jaws of defeat here. So to tell us just a little bit more about this deal, we've got Mihailo joining us.
Yes, so now the terms of the ceasefire have, as you mentioned, actually been laid out. They've been partially implemented. The Israeli government did approve it last Saturday, and the day after that, Romy Gonen, Doron Steinbrecher and Emily Damari were released out of Hamas captivity to the Red Cross to Israel. And in exchange, Israel released 90 Palestinian, Arab, Israeli, etc. prisoners, including some people with some pretty big reputations on them. The total list, Israel has spoken a bit more about everybody that's going to be released, and the total list includes 734 convicted murderers. You mentioned the person that murdered a female prison, or raped a female prison guard in Israel, that's Mahmoud Atala. Zakaria Zebedi, a convicted terrorist, he bombed the Likud party office in 2002 that killed six. That would be the equivalent of somebody bombing a Republican office in the States. Mahmoud Abu Varda, somebody you listed, these are people you listed in your trumpet brief from earlier in the week. He is currently serving 48 life sentences for everything he's done, including a 1996 bus bombing that killed 45 people. You put this in American terms, and as Andrew mentioned, Donald Trump just called all the Mexican cartels terrorist groups. That would be the equivalent to deciding we're getting peace with the cartels by giving them back El Chapo and some of these other really infamous people. That's basically what this is to Israel. When I last spoke on this program, I was a bit more optimistic about what some of these, what this deal may entail, partially, actually mostly because knowing Trump's track record and of supporting Israel and knowing Netanyahu's track record of making the most out of bad situations and still getting what he wants, I thought there must have surely been something behind the scenes that was actually going to help Israel. And this is no way Trump is taking the side of Hamas in this. But looks like I was very much wrong with that.
Well, I still think there's an important caveat to say there that, yeah, like, this could change. And you're right. Both of these people do have an impressive track record. Mm-hmm. So I do think it is worth leaving open. Maybe there's something we're not seeing, or maybe there is a plan. Maybe this is all going to plan to fall apart. But based on what we can see so far and what we've seen this last week, this looks pretty terrible.
Indeed. And a lot of the media on the Israeli right were talking about or basically saying the exact same things about this. I mean, just looking at the rap sheets of some of these people, that's... And even when you think about Mr. Trump talking about releasing American hostages and pardoning the January 6th hostages, etc., there's still Americans in Gaza. There are still people that... I mean, so many Israelis are U.S. citizens. This is a war that directly impacts U.S. citizens. But that's not the... And again, if you hear people talk about, well, you know, Israel's already killed 40,000 Palestinians, if those numbers are even believable, Hamas has learnt his lesson, the Palestinians have learnt their lesson, you know, we've atoned for everything. We could play a bit of a B-roll footage now of some of the hostages as they're being released. This would be clip one in the... there we go. This is Hamas... soldiers out in the open, all in uniform, not afraid, supposedly holding back, if you could call it that, bunch of jeering Gazans right behind them. That does not look like Japan in the 1950s. That does not look like a country that's, you know, accepted they've lost the war and ready to reconcile. That looks like a country that's ready for round two. And you, I mean, they've got their weapons, they've got their uniforms, they're still there. Hamas has not been defeated. Hamas is ready to keep going on pushing. And if you look at how Trump is framing this, though, as you mentioned, we're a bit short on time, so we could just skip completely to clip three. This is how Trump introduced the hostages in his inaugural address or the topic.
Like in 2017, we will again build the strongest military the world has ever seen. We will measure our success not only by the battles we win, but also by the wars that we end, and perhaps most importantly, the wars we never get into. My proudest legacy will be that of a peacemaker and unifier. That's what I want to be, a peacemaker and a unifier. I'm pleased to say that as of yesterday, one day before I assumed office, the hostages in the Middle East are coming back home to their families.
You compare what he just said there with that other scene we just showed you of Hamas. You know, that does not sound like bringing peace to me. That almost sounds like a... You could almost say that was Donald Trump's Neville Chamberlain moment where he flies in like, okay, we've settled peace. Who cares about Czechoslovakia? We're not concerned about them. We just made Germany happy and now we have peace for our time.
And is it even true? And Mr. Flory made this point yesterday, but... there are still hostages there. I thought initially, okay, he's got all the American hostages out. That must be what he's talking about. But I was wrong. Like, that's not even true. There's still American hostages that haven't been released yet, right?
Well, I mean, maybe this will be different. But last time I checked, Hamas hasn't said who they're going to release tomorrow. But, well, we have two Israeli nationals and one dual British national that were released Sunday. Three people. And a lot of the hostages that Hamas is saying they're going to release in exchange for all these murders, they're dead bodies. We don't even know how many people in Gaza, those hostages, are still alive. Hamas probably doesn't even know. And so we're releasing, again, the equivalent if the U.S. released the Boston bomber or somebody really notorious for dead bodies. That is pretty, like, crippling, you could say, if this doesn't get mended somehow for the state of Israel. We have one more clip. This is from a Key of David that hasn't aired yet, but our sister program, The Trumpet Daily, aired them, so they're fair game. It's a composite clip of what Mr. Fleury is thinking about the current deal.
But I'll tell you this what Mr. Trump has done here is going to plague him from the very beginning to the end of his tenure in office. That is a fact, that, and you wait and see if it doesn't happen that way, unless there's some a big change in what he's doing. He has disgraced Netanyahu, and it's just a catastrophe that it's hard to even describe. But here, if you look at this and just say, well, what is it that President Trump really needs? Well, he needs somebody to help him understand what is happening in the Middle East. And he has to see in time what a catastrophe he has caused in the Jewish state in the Middle East, our only real ally. And they have been a strong one. And now, where does that leave us in the Middle East? What kind of power do we have there? Well, it's not encouraging.
That, I think, ties in pretty well with what Jeremiah and you were talking about with Taiwan and some of these other places. I mean, and to Trump's credit, America is war-weary. It's an astronomical debt. I'm sure the country's doing some soul-searching to trim the fat of some of these events that, in a lot of people's minds, don't even directly impact Americans. But as it gets here from Mr. Fleury there, God doesn't... Yes, he cares about what's going on in the United States, but he cares about what's going on in other countries too, especially the state of Israel. And for America to abandon Israel in its hour of need like this, again, as you said, it's early days, maybe there's something we don't see, but he doesn't take that lightly. And even spiritually, when somebody, there's a scripture in Zechariah that calls Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all that try and deal with it. God takes very serious attention. It pays very serious attention to what happens in Jerusalem. And if somebody is going out of their way to harm Israel like that, you could be sure that God isn't going to let that slide too easily. The particular scripture that this came into mind is Isaiah 9, verse 21. Not one we go to often, but it talks about these nations in their ancestral names, Manasseh being the United States, Ephraim being Britain, and Judah being the state of Israel. And it says, Manasseh, Ephraim, and Ephraim, Manasseh, and they together shall be against Judah. And that basically says that the brotherhood between these three countries will be broken and that they're going to start attacking each other in pretty serious ways. The rest of this chapter talks about, for all this, God's anger is not turned away. This is a curse from God. God is letting this division happen because of people rejecting him, because of people embracing their sins, defying him. And the very fact that you could see this happening with Manasseh and Judah in this case shows that curses are still coming on the nations of prophetic Israel. The curses are not going away. Even if there is a resurgence coming, there are still big problems for the nations, for America, for Britain, and for the Jewish state. And if our listeners, if our viewers would like to learn more about that, Mr. Fleury has a booklet called Jerusalem and Prophecy. It was written before any of this chaos and whatnot happening in Gaza and Israel happened, but what he writes there, it's still pretty relevant. It's especially relevant to what's happening today.
Well, thank you for that. And yes, Jerusalem in Prophecy, a great place to go to understand this this focus or this critical part of the world. Also, the United States and Britain in Prophecy is a great place to understand, well, what's God doing with America? And you mentioned Manasseh, that quote. And that book proves that the United States is descended from Manasseh and shows how these scriptures apply to the modern United States. Well, do you want to just finish up with a brief rundown of everything else that's been going on in the Middle East?
Yes, a lot of these stories would be our main story if it weren't for everything else happening. There are unconfirmed reports that Turkey and the Kurdistan Workers Party, or PKK, have reached a settlement. PKK, a terrorist group, or at least used to be a terrorist group. Turkey still considers them, most of the West still considers them that. They've been having an on and off war in Turkey, within the borders of Turkey, since the 1980s. And if the media reports are to be believed, it's still unconfirmed by official sources, but the PKK pledges to demilitarize while the Turkish government will release its leader, Abdullah Öcalan, from prison and draft a new Turkish constitution guaranteeing Kurdish rights. Turkey obviously is a very important nation prophetically that we've talked about many times on this program, especially with what's going on in Syria. how their dealings with the Kurds within Turkey will impact geopolitical events in other countries remains to be seen, but it still is a major conflict that overnight it seems to have disappeared. And one other report or story that I'd like to bring up is that other local media reports citing Iraqi government sources suggest that the Iraqi government will integrate the Popular Mobilization Unit into its regular armed forces, the PMU. In other words, these Shiite militias that Iran used to sponsor that helped defeat ISIS, that got so rowdy, Iraq gave them semi-official status. So they were part of the government already, but sort of doing their own little thing. So Iraq could keep them at a bit of an arm's length. Now it looks like they want to integrate them fully into the official army, which is not what the U.S. obviously wants, because, again, they're sponsored by Iran, because they're terrorist groups, because they're attacking Israel. But the fact that Iraq could say these kinds of things, I think it shows the power that Iran already has, and Iraq knows it can't really do anything at this point to get rid of them. They have to make the most out of the bad situation. But also, I think it also shows how much the Iraqi government doesn't care what the U.S. thinks, and that even though the U.S. helped set up this semi-democratic government in Iraq, they are not the U.S.'s friends anymore, and they are definitely, between America and Iran, are choosing sides. Iran in Iraq is here to stay.
And I also saw one story that caught my eye was it looked like Syria has gotten kicked out of this naval base in
Russia.
Russia, yes, out of this naval base in Syria, at least according to Syrian media, I think Russian media as well, which if that's confirmed, that's a pretty big blow to Russia, moving them out of the Mediterranean. So that could be a pretty big victory for Europe as they try to get control of the Mediterranean. Well, thank you so much, Mihailo, to all of our panelists, to George Haddad and Isaac Lorenz for engineering and production, and for you, the viewer, and to, I said thank you to the panelists, but also to Joshua, who joined us to talk about Europe's response. We do have coming up on Wednesday an interview I'm very excited about that Joshua has done with an international lawyer and politician from Cyprus, a critical geostrategic spot. They're still working on the production, so I've not had a chance to watch it yet, but I am eagerly anticipating that. It sounded like a really, really interesting interview. So that will be up on our YouTube page, our Rumble page on Wednesday. So if you want to make sure you catch that, please do give us a like and a follow. And until then, keep watching your world.